Okay, I think we'll get started. Is that too loud? Okay. Thank you for all coming today. Just a quick story. First, my 9-year-old nephew came over to visit me the other day. He's quite an inquisitive guy, and we got talking, and I said, "I'm going down to this philanthropy conference later this week," and he said to me, "Oh, Uncle Dillard, is that right? What does philanthropy mean?" And I said, "Well, that's a good question. Let's go to the dictionary." And with that, I said, "You know, definitely the dictionary, not the internet, the old-fashioned way." And he started thumbing through the dictionary, and we were looking together, and page by page, and got to the word just above philanthropy. That was close enough for him. Philanderer. To engage in love affairs. What does that mean, Uncle Dillard? True story. So needless to say, I won't tell you the whole conversation, but my profession, or our profession, has little credibility in his eyes now. That's the point. But that leads into the credibility. I think that we certainly have a very credible panel group here today with us. They're all CEOs of their individual organizations, and I'm pleased to be here today with them. Together, collectively, they represent over 110 years plus in terms of service for their organizations, their tenures. They have aggregate budgets, annual budgets of over $400 million, and they have an aggregate impact, I think, somewhere in the area of 15 million kids. So they are a well-qualified group to talk to us about youth development. I can't think of, you know, a more important topic these days when we think of a number of the things that Bob talked about last night, but talking about dropout rates, high as they are in schools, we're talking about substance abuse, we're talking about teenage pregnancies, we're talking about recidivism, we're talking about these days about fatherlessness and lack of mentors. So all very important. I think we have Karen Mathis here, we have Neil Nicole here, we have Bob Mazuka, who we all got to know a little bit last night, did a great job. And Roxanne Spillett. They're each going to speak for about 8 minutes in terms of their own business models, their individual strategies, their niches, if you will. I think we're also going to hear from them to some degree in terms of how they may collaborate with others as well as among their organizations. We at the F.M. Kirby Foundation is a family organization. We support all four of these organizations either on a national or a local basis. And as many of you, we're always, you know, careful looking at for duplication in services. I think in this case, we recognize there's really enough out there for them all, and we're less concerned about that. But they all still do have their own expertise, own strengths, et cetera, and we're going to hear about that some. And then I think we're also going to hear some in terms of their discussion around philanthropy and the role of philanthropy as they see it in their organizations. So with that, as I say, I'll let each of them speak about 8 to 10 minutes about their organizations, and then we'll come back and hopefully have an engaged 40 minutes or so of Q&A. All right, sound good? So why don't we start with Karen. I'm not going to go in depth in terms of their bio because you all have it in front of you. But Karen has been is an attorney for 34 years. And as she says, she's a child advocate by choice. She's actually our youngster in terms of tenure, if you will, just having joined Big Brothers Big Sisters about a year ago. And she had a very interesting time. taking a 1 year leave from her law firm before joining Big Brothers Big Sisters, and that's again outlined in the bio, but she was in Prague for a year, and I think she prides herself on the fact that she led that organization, CELI, for that full year, and didn't speak the local language. So, without further ado, Karen, I think you wanted to get up, right?
I'm going
to
get up.
Yeah.
Thank you, Dillard, and let me thank the Philanthropy Roundtable for including us on this very distinguished panel. You know, I am the new person with Big Brothers Big Sisters, but it was 40 years ago that I first served as a big sister. And certainly have seen the difference in my nephew's life. He was matched when he was 8 years old to his big brother. He'll be 25 in February, and he and Jeff are still together. But when I look at this distinguished panel, let me just tell you that every one of their organizations has had an impact on my life. Roxanne, my nieces and nephews, are dependents of military personnel, and they have enjoyed the clubs not just in the United States, but at their bases around the world. Bob, as I told you last night, I've served on about 10 panels for Eagle Scouts, and those young men are amazing, and they will be the future leaders of our country. And Neil, I learned to swim at the Y. So I think, Dillard, when you say there's enough room for all of us, it's actually very, very true. Let me tell you that Big Brothers Big Sisters of America is the nation's premier one-on-one mentoring organization. We work in over 5,000 American communities through 377 agencies, and in 2009 we mentored over 250,000 children. That means that there were also 250,000 adults who spent an average of 90 hours with one child, making a difference in that child's life. So we are 106 years old. We have wisdom, we have experience, and we also have the creativity and the passion to embrace new ideas, new methods, and an exciting vision that all children achieve success in life. Our piece of that mission, or vision, our mission, is to provide children facing adversity with strong, enduring, professionally supported one-on-one relationships that are going to change their lives for the better forever. And we hold ourselves accountable for certain outcomes and impact in society. We believe that for every child in our program, they will achieve higher aspirations, greater confidence, and better relationships. They will also avoid those risky behaviors that Dillard was just speaking about, and we will be accountable with others for their educational success. I believe that our program interrupts the trajectory of children facing extraordinary odds, and it puts them on a different path, a path to success. We stay with each child, not for a few days or months, but for years, to ensure that the depth and the breadth of this relationship will really stick. Our professional staff member works in partnership with every child's parent or guardian, their mentor, their school, and other community organizations such as these fine organizations to ensure a safe, strong, and enduring web of support for each and every child in our program. We know that the children we are mentoring who do face significant adversity will, through our program and long and strong mentoring relationships, become responsible, productive citizens who are able to achieve lifelong success, make our communities safer, and we will have a better prepared workforce as a result. Our littles, as we call our mentees, are taxpayers, not tax takers. Let me tell you the story of Victor. He's a little brother who is our little brother of the year. He went to meet President Obama in the Oval Office. I enjoyed meeting him very much. Victor's from my first generation Hispanic family. He's in Oklahoma City, and he decided to go back to visit his fifth grade teacher. And what he learned was that this year he is going to be the only child from that entire fifth grade class that will graduate high school. That's pretty sad. And yet it's repeated all over the country. And through his big brother, Art, he has stayed away from risky behavior. He has stayed in school. He has not been in the juvenile justice system. He's gotten very good grades. And he's now scouting colleges. Now, Art, who's a mechanical engineer, would like him to go to MSU up in Michigan. But we'll see what Victor decides. That's what I call a life interrupted for good. You know, Our volunteer mentors work with a child. There are many different ways of helping children, and you're going to hear different types of formats. But we work with a child, not many in a group. And so we have supported systems that take care of and work with the adult, the parent, the child. I think it's important for you to know that we track real-time progress for each and every child. We're also able to aggregate that into a community and actually into the entire country. But we are looking at individual children for their success in our program and in their community. We do collaborate very deeply with government, with schools, with community organizations such as these, and we share accountability for our children. The issue often comes up about, what about return on investment? What is the ROI? We've done quite a bit of research, and we have found that if we can help 1 in 8 of our children graduate high school, we have proven the ROI because of the demographics of the children we are representing. Many of them, in fact, something like 50% of them, will not graduate from high school and move on to post-secondary education. If 1 in 18 of our children do not repeat the parent's mistake and go to prison, we have proven the ROI. And so we have a youth outcomes survey that does look at whether we are achieving outcomes in scholastic competency, grades, educational expectations, social acceptance, parental trust, and having a trusted adult in life. We are intentional about the children that we serve. We are serving children who are facing adversity. 69% of our little brothers and sisters are non-white. 35% of our volunteers are non-white. 74% of our youth are from single-parented families, and 16% of them have an incarcerated parent. 42% receive free or low-cost lunches, meaning they are in poverty and do not have the resources many children have. I want to talk just momentarily about collaboration. More than 50 of our agencies collaborate and have site-based one-on-one mentoring in Roxanne's clubs. Over 300 clubs where we put site-based mentoring because we have several ways of doing this program. One's in schools, one's in sites, some of them are at corporations, and then what you mostly know is a community-based one-on-one where you go out. The difference is that it's always one adult, one child. We are working with the Y's. We are working with Scouts. And so this is a program that works together. If you look at all of the programs that we're talking about, what we're looking at is less initiation of drugs, 46%, 70% less likely to ever start using drugs, 27% less likely to use alcohol, a third less likely to assault people. Let me stop by saying I'll look forward to your questions. I think we've got a great panel. Thank you for all being here, and thanks so many of you for supporting one or all of our organizations.
Thank you, Karen. Okay, Neil? Neil is with, now say the why, right?
Okay. Correct.
Neil was telling me a little interesting story that he actually, I think it had to be the late 60s, was working at the Y. He was executive branch head at the Y in Dorchester, Mass. And at the time that he started, I think they were almost like the first day, right?
Yeah.
It was a day that they initiated the school busing. And the high school was directly across from the Y. And so that first 2 weeks, I understand it, there were riots going on.
Yeah.
And it's just an incredible start for you. A little scary.
I think the thing that now, all these years later, that's even more scary. A few months ago, it came up somehow informally with a group of young staff, and one of them said, "Oh yeah, I think we studied that in civics class." I'm not sure if I was more scared with the weapons that were flying around my head 45 years ago, or realizing that it's now studied in civics class. I'm going to, if it's okay with you, work just from here and give you a little bit of information about the YMCA and kind of how we approach what we do with young people and put it in a context, because our service is to the entire age span from birth to grave, and so I'll try to give you a sense of how that works. Philosophically, we approach our youth programs in a way that says kids and their needs for healthy development have not changed over the course of history. No matter how far back you want to go, the things that young people need in their lives in order to grow up healthy, productive adults remain exactly the same. Our children today live in very, very complex environments with challenges that my generation and generations before may not have had. But it doesn't change the fact that the same things I benefited from a child are the things they will benefit from. The interesting thing is the kids haven't changed the rules, the adults have changed the rules. None of the things the kids are dealing with today are the result of something they created. It's something that adults created for them. And so they are challenged with that. Our approach is to basically simplify life for kids and try to get as many of the distractions in their life moved away so that they are placed in an environment where they are loved and they are guided, they are challenged and nurtured to grow up to become healthy adults. All of our programs, and all of us could sit here probably and take most of your day and tell you about all of our programs, but the programs are simply tools. I spent a lot of my years in Seattle, and I always reminded myself that Boeing has tools that they use, and the end result is an airplane. We have programs that are our tools. The end result is an adult who's going to give something back to their community, be a good parent, and support other children as they grow up. So that's kind of the approach we take, and as I mentioned a few of these programs, please keep in mind, over our 160 years of serving in this country, the tools have changed completely. They'll change over the next couple of generations. The end result doesn't change. We serve just over 9 million children a year. Half of them, just over half of them, come to us through family memberships, so a little bit different approach to some of our youth programs in that it's the total family that is participating. 53% of our kids come from families and homes in the community where the family income is below the median of the community. And our strategies are threefold. First, as Karen said, a lot of this is done through collaboration. And we really, through partnerships with a number of organizations, including Big Brothers, Big Sisters, Boys and Girls Clubs, Boy Scouts, have been able to leverage our impact. We keep track of all of that. So just quickly, and I don't want to bore you with numbers, but over 400 of our YMCAs collaborate with Boys and Girls Clubs. Over 900 collaborate with Boys and Boy Scouts. Almost 500 collaborate with Big Brothers, Big Sisters. These are big numbers, and in communities where people realize that they really can leverage impact. Most of those collaborations are focused particularly on kids who are the most challenged in the communities. And I think the beauty of our working together is that for the most challenged of kids, we're able to surround them with multiple efforts through all of our organizations so that we're catching kids who would otherwise slip through the cracks and giving them the support they need. As I said, a lot of what we do is targeted at the family through family programming with their kids and working together. This is a little bit of a different approach from many youth serving organizations. We try to engage with families in multiple ways, and this examples, if you play in a youth sports program with a YMCA, you're likely to have a cookout with all the other families after every single activity. We have large family centers in our facilities so that the families are participating together. Family nights, our camps operate family camps for the families to come together. So kids are with their parents. Non-traditional families make up a large percentage of our population in these family memberships, and is really the effective way we approach this to try to make a material difference in the lives of kids with a direct connection to a parent in the process. At the same time, we target 45% of the young people that we serve simply as a youth who participates in our programs. Because no child is denied participation because of their inability to pay, the vast majority of our kids in specific programs are children from low-income homes. We will have this week just over 700,000 kids in child care, different children, over the course of the week. And we are always reminding ourselves that child care really is about allowing a family to have comfort during the day, that their children are safe, they are being nurtured, and they are growing up in the way that the parents would want them to grow up if, in fact, they were with them every moment of every day. We run a large number of leadership and youth development programs, minority achievers programs. With the challenges in education across this country, we've become much more heavily involved in education. A number of our YMCAs have opened charter schools in the last 3 years, and we are heavily involved in that movement. We are directly engaged through early learning programs. We are working closely with the Boeing Company to engage with new immigrant families, low-income families at birth to 3 years of age to prepare children for school, because we know that success rates, graduation from high school increased by 20%, incarceration rates dropped by 22% as a result of children being engaged in early learning programs. We do a lot of impact measurement on specific programs, so we know what our outcomes will be. One of our impact challenges, as Garrett Boone, the president of the Container Store, in front of the Container Store, said to me, you know, I've been involved with the YMCA since I was 4 years old. I'm now in my early 60s. If you try to measure your impact on me, all you're doing is picking a moment in time, because I hope I've got another 20 years to be engaged with the YMCA. And so for us, it's over a continuum in trying to assess where people are in that continuum. As you know, and I'll finish up by saying the YMCA has gone through a major rebrand revitalization. We have done the most extensive research on the YMCA movement ever done in our 160-year history. Happy to share that if you have questions, but it is driving a whole new look with intentionality about how we're going to be of service across communities in this country, and we look forward to continuing to work with our colleagues as we have more and more impact and really leverage the scale of our organization in communities all over the United States. Thank you.
Thank you, Neil. You both have already brought up a number of things that I'm kind of biting the not to interject and ask some questions, but I just want to keep moving along. Okay, so Bob, again, great job last night. I think we learned a lot of things about you already, including the fact that you're a son of a Italian immigrant, right? And what else? But we learned a lot of things. I know you know how to tie some knots and save lives, and so that's all real good stuff. I just found out so many of the things that you talked about last night of real interest to this group. So, without further ado, give us your model.
Thank you, Dillard. I'm going to pick up where Neil left off in a second about the whole rebranding exercise, because that's where we find ourselves. But before I do, it's probably helpful and instructive to understand the differences in delivery models that we all represent. Scouting is a uniquely, rather than being facilities-based, for example, we go into partnerships with organizations, churches, and civic groups and others who have an interest and a mission to serve kids, and through this partnership arrangement, deliver scouting in communities, in church basements, and in YMCAs, and in Boys and Girls Clubs. So thank you for the overhead relief that you give us with the facilities. And it's driven primarily through... Yeah, you can get uniforms. It's driven primarily through a volunteer organization. As I mentioned last night, we've got about 3 million kids and 1.2 million volunteers engaged on a regular basis, on a weekly basis, in delivering this program to young people. And we do that on a franchise kind of model through local Boy Scout councils. And it really isn't, I wish it were sometimes a monolith where someone in Dallas could decide that the whole world's going to sing off the same song sheet, but that doesn't really work. But we have 299 local councils across the country, including in the Far East and in Europe, serving U.S. dependents overseas. And so that's sort of our delivery model through community-based organizations and chartered partners. Our largest largest partners are, in fact, churches of all kinds and all denominations and all flavors. But for us right now, it's an interesting time. As I mentioned last night, 100 years, as you've earned the right to a little arthritis and a little stodginess, but we had truly become a very bureaucratic. One of our pride points was that it took at least 8 years, by golly, to get a new merit badge approved. Well, the whole world changes every year. Not, 8 years is a lifetime. We had layers and silos and all the things that you've come to expect of a bureaucracy. And so we hired McKinsey to come in and help us take a real, spotlight, independent look at how we're organized, how we deliver, and our efficiencies. And one of the things that we learned about ourselves was in fact, we truly were a bureaucracy. So we've kind of blown all that up, and we've reinvented our approach to organization. And then out of that has come also a realization that this whole Hispanic dynamic that we talked about last evening and the whole world and issue of technology and social media and social networking and all of those things, we really had to learn, have to learn how to engage people where they are, young people where they are, where they get their information today, where they form their opinions today. And that's been an exciting road for us. And it's been an interesting development of relationship with philanthropists in that process. And I think, one of the things that I'm really fascinated about is this whole notion of philanthropy as partner rather than donor, as investor rather than donor. And one of the things that I'm really thrilled about as we go down this road is there are people who are willing to go with us at some high risk, it's okay to fail opportunities, where we can actually push the envelope and do some things that we've been afraid to do before because we've been afraid to fail. So it's been a whole reinvention, an exercise that we're really excited about. Our goal is identical to the goals here, and it's intervention and prevention rather than, it's very difficult to build metrics that prove because a young man was a Boy Scout or went to the Y or was in fact a big, that they did not get in trouble. It's much easier to hold up a broken child or someone who did get in trouble and show how we're going to fix that person. And yet, in fact, through the help of Dr. Templeton and the his foundation and the kinds of things, we're building ways to actually prove that these outcomes, in fact, are measurable. We can provide empirical data that will say to the community, we're really seriously, truly interested in proving that we can produce outcomes that are beneficial to the community. We all have good, warm, fuzzy feelings about short pants, long socks, and helping ladies across the street. But what really does that have to do with making a difference in a community? And so we're engaged in devising ways to prove that, in fact, it is a valuable asset. So it's a work in progress. We call it the new BSA, Film at 11. Check with us in a couple of years, and we'll let you know truly how we're doing. But it's an honor to be here, and I'm delighted to be with these great folks that does such great work around the world. And Roxanne, you can go next. I'm ready for the questions.
Thank you, Bob. One thing I didn't mention, I've learned this group, they travel a lot. I was talking to Bob's assistant who indicated that in this past year, he's been on the road 258 days, I think, so far. Like that. It's just incredible. So having their commitment to being here today even means more to me when I hear that kind of schedule. Roxanne, thank you for being with us here today. Known your organization for quite a few years. I remember a few years ago, I think it was 06 or 07, Newsweek had a big article and named you and Boys and Girls Club as 15 people who are making America great, and I think that's pretty good, pretty darn good job. I know I read somewhere else that your father was actually a baker, is that right? And your mom was an artist, and you took a much different track, and you're a youth developer, and I'm sure they're both very proud of you. And tell us what you have to say.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Bill. It's great to be here. As I listen to my colleagues, I have one recurring thought, and that is America is blessed because of the institutions that exist in our communities and exist with a mission that is not about money but is about human lives. And so, I feel honored to be here, and I feel like the country is blessed. I also feel like we got a lot more to do, and that in these particular times, the needs are exponentially increasing, and it's incumbent upon us and upon the country to begin to think about how we can reach even more kids, because you know and I know that the number of kids that are hungry in this country are growing exponentially. The number of kids who don't have a winter coat are growing exponentially. The number of families who can't pay their light bills are growing exponentially. So while I feel like the country's blessed, I feel like America has to come together around children in an even greater way than we've done in the past. So it's really an honor and a pleasure for me to be here representing Boys and Girls Clubs, and I think everybody has described their model, and I will describe it. We're all a little different. I think it's same game, different team. You know, we all have the same goals in mind, and that makes me very proud, quite honestly. But Boys and Girls Clubs have been around for 150 years. We started as boys clubs. Many of you know that. In Hartford, Connecticut, that first club in 1860 was actually, now don't tell anybody this, started by three women. And we have been, we were Boys Clubs of America until 1990, and, there was a movement afoot. There was the legal system was asking questions. The father who showed up at the club with his son and said, you know, my son can go swimming here. Why can't my daughter? The United Ways and other funding sources began to put pressure on the Boys and Girls Club movement, and in 1990 we became Boys and Girls Clubs of America, which in my view had to be not just a name change. It had to be a change in the way we thought of ourselves and in the way we included girls and women in the Boys and Girls Club movement, and in a way that would treat boys and girls with equal respect, attention, and dignity. And I think that we've achieved that. We're always looking to do better. But that first day that we, and all of this was very controversial. Imagine that in the boys' club movement. I think, you know, that transformation was a very healthy one. And I think our clubs are better places now because we are serving boys and girls, although there are some programs where boys have their time alone and some where girls have their time alone. But much of what we do is co-ed and reinforcing the need for boys and girls to treat each other with equal respect, attention, and dignity. Just a little historical fact. But our mission is pretty much similar. Our mission is to serve all young people with a special focus on those who need us most and help them to become responsible, productive, caring citizens. Our vision, very simple, is to help assure that success is within the reach of every child and whole generations of children rise and are inspired to a level of civic engagement not seen since the founding of our nation. That's really what we aspire to be a part of, and that's what we work toward every day. Our model, we are facility-based. We have paid professional staff supplemented by volunteers. We also have daily access to our clubs. Some of our clubs are open 5 days a week. Some are open six. Quite honestly, some are open on Sundays, 7 days a week. We have diversified programs. We also have extremely low dues because our focus is on kids who have the greatest obstacles in life and the least opportunities. And when it comes to what our greatest asset is, and I think everybody here would agree, it is our people, and that our staff are life coaches for our kids. Our staff are mentors for our kids. And in the end, I believe that it is that caring relationship that is the heart of impact on kids from the best of circumstances and kids from the worst of circumstances. Our kids call our club their home, their second home, their home away from home, their only home. We are now have a footprint of 4,000 clubs. We are serving maybe 4.2 million young people through membership and community outreach. We have clubs on Native American lands. We have 250 clubs on Native American lands and Native Alaskan lands. We are in public housing. We have nearly 500 clubs in public housing. We are on military bases here in the United States and U.S. military bases across the world. But we also have a major outreach effort in this country to find young people whose mother or father have been deployed and are living in our communities, Reserve, National Guard, active duty, living off base, so that we can bring them into our home, our family, and support military families. And I know you're aware of this. Those families where there is a deployment, there's unusual, extraordinary stress on the kids and the family as a whole, and our objective is to locate them in communities and bring them into our clubs. We have a research-based theory of change, and that theory of change helps us to assure that we're impacting young lives. In terms of our priorities is to be that home away from home, but it is also about academic success. It's also about healthy lifestyles, and it's also about service and civic engagement. Those are our three major programmatic priorities. They're the kind of things you want for your own children and grandchildren. Those are the things that we all want for all of America's children. I would say when it comes to the question, so how do you know you're effective? We have anecdotal stories, as you all do. We also have surveys of our alumni, and our alumni are very clear, and we do this every couple of years. 28% of our alumni say if not for the Boys and Girls Club, they would never have graduated from high school. 67% say the Boys and Girls Club kept me out of trouble with the law. 92% say they care about other people and they care about their communities because of what they learned at the Boys and Girls Club. 57% of them say that the Boys and Girls Club saved their lives. We also do very rigorous evaluation. We evaluate our clubs in public housing and see the kind of impact that has. In fact, that level of rigor helped us to secure very significant funding to expand the Boys and Girls Club movement. From really at one point, 1996, we had 1,800 clubs. Today we have 4,000 clubs. I will tell you this, that we have 51,000 full and part-time employees, over 200,000 volunteers, and our revenues to support this network of 4,000 clubs is $1.5 billion. Our clubs are out there raising money every day to support the valuable work they do to change and save young lives. We spent 15 years doubling the size of the Boys and Girls Club movement, 15 years. That was part one of our strategy. Part two is to become as deep in our impact as we are broad in our reach. Our job is America's job to raise children, to support them, to make sure they're fed, and to help them have aspirations that will enable them to lead the country in the years ahead. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Roxanne.